state. All right, guys. Wearable computing and embodied interaction. I'm going to describe wearable computer as an example of an area of application for embodied interaction vision. This is a human-computer interaction approach that really emphasizes the body as an integral part of interacting with computers and also interacting with other people. And I could not go much into details of other areas of application because there are plenty of them, like tangible user interfaces, natural user interfaces. These are very interesting hot topics in human-computer interaction. But I chose wearable computing because I think it's easy for us to prototype and relate. Tangible user interface takes a lot of time to prototype and also to imagine how to use in our everyday. I think wearables is closest to that. That's why I chose it. So basically, wearables and embodied interaction, they are reactions towards this inevitable evolution of the human body, or not exactly an evolution, more like a devolution or something, inverted evolution. Like, we started crawling and walking like really in a primitive way as primates, and we learned how to stand up and use tools. And those tools became more heavier and stronger and more complex to the point that they become a general tool for doing everything, which is the computer. And once you can do everything with just one tool, you just sit in front of it, and then you stay your whole day over there. And you become, you start to suffer from health problems because you are too over-sedentary. Sedentary, I don't know how to pronounce that. Sedentary. So is it our fate? I don't think so. And a lot of researchers are criticizing this trend of making the computer more important in our lives and staying and reacting against sitting in front of the computer the whole day. And these people, they asked why. Why the computer is going towards that way? Because we think that we are just... Because a lot of people that build computers, they think that users are like Homer Simpson. And Homer Simpson only thinks about sleep, donuts, duff beer. So he has a very restricted mind, and the mind controls Homer behaviors. So if you design a computer for Homer's mind, he will stay the whole day sitting in front of the computer and interacting, and he will be fine. And so this new trend of researchers that are criticizing this approach, they say, you are ignoring the whole body of Homer Simpson and the user and everybody else that interacts with the computer. There's a lot more about Homer's behavior that are not in his mind. So that, although this looks funny because those are indeed themes of the cartoon, that's not about his life. He has a lot of other interests, and this is shown in the thousands of episodes that has been already aired on the television show. The new approach that researchers are proposing, instead of considering the mind and the mental models, is this approach of embodied cognition or embodied interaction. Once you come to human-computer interaction, they switch from embodied cognition to embodied interaction. But in the end, it's the, some there are some basic assumptions between these two different words and terms. The guy who wrote extensively about this is called Paul Dirich. He's pretty known in the human-computer interaction area, also in the computer-supported collaborative work, and also in social computing and other areas. He's quite a famous computer science researcher. And his perspective, humans interact with the world through the active existence of their bodies. And if you don't have a body, you don't exist in the world, basically, in this perspective. So you exist because you have a body over there. And you might say, well, my computers were built exactly to transcend the limitations of the body, right? Well, what he's saying is that, no, actually, computers, they are extending the possibilities of our bodies to reach and not replacing the body. And if we try to replace the body, we might end up with these health issues that we have right now. Once we ignore it and try to say, well, let's leave behind the body, we are losing opportunities for engaging the body with the computer. And that's the idea of embodied interaction. So a person is interacting with a computer in a specific place, which is ruled by social norms, and that is a huge context, a complex context that sometimes you might not grasp at first, you might not understand, but once you start thinking about it, like Homer, thinking that you are in a context with your body, thinking that you are eating some food. So this exercise of thinking in terms of bodily relationships, so Homer is thinking about himself sleeping while dreaming on eating something with his hands. So
very deep
thoughts, right? But very embodied thoughts. He's present with his full body in all of them. And this is what embodied interaction is about. It's a different lens, a perspective to look at human-companion interaction. I met at the University of Twente one of the researchers in this stream. He's called Jelle van Dijk. And he was quite, like me, feeling a bit out of place in that university, because the university is quite engineering-minded and a lot of cognitive research is being done over there. But he was an embodied interaction researcher, and he wanted to develop, and he's now basically doing that. But at the beginning, he was quite lost. And he recently, I think this year, he published a very interesting article on this topic where he proposes a diagram on a model, which is called D4EB, which means, I don't remember what exactly it means, but it means, but the meaning, the overall meaning of this model is that to consider that people have brains, people have bodies, people have emotions, people have sensory-motor skills that are useful, that must be, that should be used by and employed, availed by the materials, the computers, the technologies that we have in our world, to interact with other people, because interacting with other people is what constitutes our world. The life world, the living we take in this world is a social world, is a social life. And therefore, we need to consider all of these things. So, touch, sight, the mediation of the technology we use to increase, to extend our body's abilities. So all of these are interesting aspects to look once you consider embodied interaction. So it's basically expanding the scope of human-computer interaction. If you remember what we saw in the cognitive engineering approach and the semiotic engineering approach and later on the pattern-based design approach, we are progressively, slowly towards expanding the scope. So in the beginning, it was not just about the user mental model. Remember the conceptual model, user mental model, and the designer's mental model. And the system was an instantiation of that model. That's the vision of Donald Norman, who proposed the cognitive engineering approach. In semiotics, we had the designer talking, the dialogue with the user. And then in pattern-based design, we had these collective designers, the collective group of people designing things in different ways. And now we are discussing that those people, they all have bodies, they have feelings, they have senses, they have sensorimotor skills, they have social life, and so on. So we are gradually expanding. In the next class, we are going to finally finish our expansion. So we're going to discuss activity theory, which is even broader than embodied interaction. So I'm basically guiding you in a stepwise understanding of human-computer interaction that's much broader than most researchers in Brazil, they approach the topic, as we discussed in the beginning. But just to remind you, coming back to embodied interaction, which is the topic of our lecture today, this is the history of embodied interaction. At the beginning, there was no wearable computer, right? There was no embodied interaction in terms of design or something to be to allow interactions. This came in the late 19th, in the 20th century. However, if we look back to the history of wearables, we can find some forerunners of this trend in ancient China, like almost 3,000 years ago, more than 3,000 years ago, we could see already find the need to have information attached to the body. And this is called an abacus ring, and women at Chinese, they say the Chinese royal family. I don't know what's the name. There's a name for it, a special family. What? The royal family, the noble people. The noble women, they wore this ring because once they went to the market, they were doing the calculations by themselves, and they were also charging taxes to the marketeers. And this was used as a power device too, because those people didn't have access to such a fine detailed artisanship. This is not something unusual for that time. Not everybody had this artifact. In the 20th century, as I said, we started in something almost like a wearable computer with the pulsar calculator watch. In 1975, this was the first calculator that you can wear attached to your body. It had an LED display, which means a lot of energy was being put on that. It could not be turned on all the time. So you had to press a button. So you had to press pulsar, this button here, to see what was the time. It was not showing all the time. And you say, oh, this is primitive. Yeah, but have you tried using an Apple Watch? It's the same. Apple Watch is not turning on all the time because it's also... And it's not, I don't think it's LED any longer, but it's also an energy expensive solution. It's much more consuming, much more demanding than the crystal liquid displays, which I love and I really miss them. I loved my crystal liquid Palm VX and I miss it so much. But I am sure that it will come back one day. They are so nice. All right, so come back to calculate watch. This was heavy, and it was definitely a businessman device, so you could show a lot of status with this thing on your wrist. And it cost a lot, but it definitely took off, and a lot of people start wearing these calculators, and it took some 20 years or so to come to the overall society, but I remember when I was a kid and I saw one first, it was really like magic. Well, how can a calculator be so tiny? But wearable computers, they are different. Calculators are not computers. Computing is much more than calculating, and it requires having algorithms and complex structures, and this only becomes possible for tiny computers that you can wear in the 90s. And in the 90s, the group that really pushed forward the idea of wearable computers were the MIT Borg Lab. They were known as the cyborgs, the first cyborgs. And I got to meet these guys while reading a super interessante article, a super interessante article about this team. And I think I was 11 years old, and I read and I looked at these guys. Man, I want to be like them. This is crazy. I want to study at MIT. How do I do this? And I really found cool. How could they already live in that world? Like, I was watching science fiction movies all the time and reading comics, but I never thought that there was already this possibility of living like that. And these guys really took it serious. They were creating those prototypes and wearing them all the time. That's the difference. They were not just building it and then being in front of the picture and then they are taking off. No, they were wearing this all the time. Especially this guy here on the left. He's called Steve Mann. And then he's the author of that article I asked you to read about the wear cam. And that's what he's wearing. Not here. He's wearing here a wear cam, old version of it. I think there's even a picture of the wear cam there where he's wearing that stuff. And he's taking a picture of himself in front of the mirror. Remember that? So, and it's sideways like 90 degrees because the system could not be put into place in a proper way. Like But it's nice. So this guy is wearing those stuff since that time, and he's really pushing forward, and he's still with the same spirit of the MIT Borg lab. The MIT Borg lab changed the name, and currently is known as Wearable Technique, Wearable Computers Group, but it's not like that group any longer. It does not do wild experimentation like this. But Steve Mann is still doing that. He's now at the University of Toronto. He's a full professor there. And one of his craziest experiments was to build a structure that you could plug artificial sensors to your brain. So there will be some electrodes inserted within your brain, like implant of electrodes that you could put under your skull. And you would wear this thing, and it will communicate through some radio frequencies or some magnetic fields. I don't know, I understand the techniques exactly. And then you would put the thing, and you could attach an artificial eye, like he's doing here, or artificial ear, or artificial senses that we don't have. Like, you could train your brain to perceive ultraviolet light, or to perceive noises that we don't see, like, or even to perceive things that we don't know. Like, for example, we don't have direct experience, like the solar radiation, or, I don't know, the magnetic fields. So we could start feeling that. And a lot of people are trying, experimenting with this kind of stuff, but Steve Mann is really known as a pioneer for that.
Sounds like the first 5 minutes of an Avengers movie.
Yeah. He's not afraid of looking like he's crazy or like a cyborg or anything like that. And he was wearing this eye tap for 10 years almost, all every day, always recording what he was doing, and also, once he got connectivity to the internet, he was also broadcasting whatever he was doing. Of course, sometimes it would switch off, but very rarely. And he had this thing attached to his skull. He could not take it off.
Really?
Yeah, he really attached the skull to be safe and be not having to change all the time.
Could he take
a bath or did he actually... I don't know. I never read anything about these details. But the thing is that he was calling in to visit Google X once they were developing the Google Glass project. He was one of the mentors of that project. And one funny situation, in 2012, Google was about to launch Google Glass. Everybody in the news was already talking about it. And people were afraid about privacy issues. And this McDonald's manager, he stopped Steve Mann from wearing that inside his restaurant. So he said, you're not allowed to use this thing here. And he said, no, but it's attached to my skull. I cannot take it off. So the guy went there and put his hand and tried to take it by force. And Steve Mann, of course, was a little bit afraid, and he was recording, and the internet, he put the pictures of the guy who was a perpetrator, and so he said really bad, nasty things about the manager, and that situation didn't help Steve Mann or either Google engineers to notice that this kind of invention would really change social interactions. And especially because it's attached to a body. And a body has a meaning in society, a lot of meaning, because a person is present there. And if a person is present, a person can do things, and glasses can allow the person to do things without you knowing that the person is doing things, because you are also having your own body in front of that person. It's so different than having Google on your computer. Having your Google on your eyeglass makes a huge difference, because there is a body there. And that's why this project was shut down in 3 years later, because they didn't take into consideration, and to my interpretation, the body seriously. They only considered the user as a mind, and it was not useful, It was very bad for privacy issues because people were aware that they were being recorded all the time. They didn't like to talk to people using that. It looked like the person was ignoring their surroundings and feeling like they were bored, and they would look through their eyes to the glass all the time. So a lot of issues that were not addressed by the design ended up making the product no good choice for the consumers. People wanted to buy. Some people wanted to buy and still want to buy Google Glass, but this is a minority. It's not a product that can sell millions of copies to really be successful, which is required for such kind of technology. I believe in the future Google or any other company might be successful with this kind of technology, with smart glasses, but they have to first learn from what Apple did with Apple Watch, because Apple Watch is definitely a success. It's not a huge success, not everybody is wearing Apple Watches, but it's still...
Apple Watches as a whole has been successful.
Yes, but I would say Apple Watch is one of the most is the most successful one. But it has a market, a specific market. It's targeted to people that have a lot of money and people that care about their bodies. So that's the point. Apple Watch successfully apply an approach of taking the body as a data source. So it's recording everything that happens with your body, how much time you are standing, how much time you are sitting down, how much time you're walking, and then it gives you some suggestions, like you're sitting for too much, why don't you go for a walk? And that's what Apple Watch does, that Google Glass could have done, because Google Glass is also attached to your body. Google Glass could also have those kind of sensors, but they just ignore the possibility of interacting with the body, embodied interaction. Google Glass also missed the point that once you are wearing a technology in the public, that technology becomes subject to fashion. And Google Glass is not fashionable. It's so horrible. It does not fit with your way of wearing. And you cannot customize. It's like, it looks like a science fiction item. It's nice for science fiction movies, but it's not nice for everyday interaction. It does not fit with other kind of clothes you're wearing. But Apple Watch does much better. You can see here an example of one... customized watch face that fits perfectly with her style, this woman. And it fits with many other ones because it's a very simple element and it's quite clear picture. So you can fit with all kinds of different stuff. It's neutral but simple and also remarkable. On the other hand, I also mentioned this, but fashion accessories are also status symbols. Do you guys know who this guy is? Stephen Murdoch. He's one of the media moguls of the United States. You know, he owns a lot of television channels and newspapers. And he, like many other businessmen I met, are wearing Apple Watches because he maybe wants to look like he's younger or he's in touch with high tech. So it looks like he is much more in touch now than if he was not wearing an Apple Watch, and that's why he wears. Even if he doesn't use it, it has an impact on people that are close to him and are looking to him and interacting with him. And these are the people that I met personally. Most of the people that had the Apple Watch that I met personally are businessmen. And they use the Apple Watch many times to look at... messages they receive all the time without looking so like assholes that are not paying attention to you. It's much quicker to do a quick wrist movement than just looking at your phone. And if you look at the phone, it looks like you're not paying attention to the person. But I know that these guys are not paying attention to me anyway, even if they're using Apple Watches. And a lot of other people that bought Apple Watches, they bought because they were not satisfied with their bodies. They wanted to lose weight, they wanted to get fitter, And they thought that Apple Watch was a great incentive to do that because he has specific apps to work out for managing your physical activity. And it's a common name on the internet to show pictures of yourself before buying the Apple Watch and after buying the Apple Watch or buying a Fitbit or any kind of fitness wearables. And Apple really profited from that. And you can see, Google Glass didn't even consider that. And the body has a biorhythm and a social rhythm, which wearables must fit in. It's not just about the physical exercise and rhythm. It's also about the sleeping time you have, the time you eat, the time you meet people, the time you do things, you do that. And as I said, they're all... Every activity you do with a wearable changes if you consider the social context. So let's look at the video that explains what I'm trying to put into words in a much more embodied way. This is a video clip by Rudy Mancuso where he was going to show the rhythms of his everyday life. And I really like it. The way he depicts everyday life, the repetitive things. I don't know if you already stopped one day to think, man, I'm doing this for the thousandth time. It's exactly the same thing. Why do I do this every day? And you just keep on doing the thing, right? You just go around and... Yeah, that's everyday life. That's cotidiano. That's... a cycle that repeats every day. So you have to do these morning routines and the afternoon routines, and you come every Friday here for this class and so on, and the teacher starts by discussing the text, and then we go through a lecture, and then we go to the exercises. And it's kind of cycle. Why do we need to be in such a rhythm? That's because our body is also constituted by rhythms, and we cannot completely get away with them. Like, we cannot run away from them. We cannot not go to the bathroom once some hours. We cannot not sleep. We cannot not mate. And all these things are part of our life. And if a technology wants to be part of that life and be so close to our body rhythms, that technology should really be aware of those rhythms. And that's the thing that I think Apple Watch is really missing the point. Apple Watch does not consider my body rhythms. The only thing that Apple Watch offers the option is to switch it off automatically at evening time, at night time. So you program it, not show any notification, not make any noise. From 11 p.m. or to 8 a.m., you choose what's the time. I think that's great. And recently, iPhone offers some options for you to avoid being too much on screen use. Like, if you are for 2 hours, like using your smartphone, it tells you, you are using it for 2 hours, why don't you go for a walk and do something else? So Apple is now trying to help people recover their body rhythms, because staying for 2 hours in front of such a tiny thing and doing stuff is definitely not good for your health, because it goes against your body rhythms. But still, there's a lot to there's a lot in this regard that must be done with the Apple Watch. And I'll give you just a quick example. A student of mine from Apple Developer Academy, she built an application for musicians to pick up the rhythm of their musics by by vibrating your wrist. And it was a quite a good idea, vibrating metronome. That was the idea of her app. And you could choose the beats per minute, 60 beats per minute, and then you would receive this feedback while playing your guitar, while playing your drums, which is really useful for a musician, because the noise there's no sound. Most metronomes are based on sound. Tack, 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 o pa, po, pa, po, pa. But this is annoying, and also covering what you are really doing with your drama or your music. So this is really a good idea, but it's not possible to do with the Apple Watch, because it has an automatic switch-off function after 30 seconds. So you can only use it for 30 seconds. After 30 seconds, you have to touch it. So you basically, bah, 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 bah. Then you have to touch it. to keep using. It's shit. They really screwed most of the ideas of our interaction designers there, because all the ideas required prolonged use. For example, you could use Apple Watch for playing games, right? And you could do body movements. And no, you can't use it, John. Just 30 seconds each game movement. So not useful at all. And the problem with Apple Watch and other computer stuff is that they are still much influenced by this cognitive view of the user, where the user is like a baby bubble head. Have you read this part of the text? At the end of the five themes for bodies in interaction design text, in the end they mention that this is the baby bubble head model. It's a funny thing. I never noticed that. It looks like really like a baby, not a really adult human, right? It's so simplified, and the human is not really like a human, right? It's more like a machine, the way it's describing here. This is old-fashioned HCI. Most people in the human computer interaction do not rely on this model like this currently, which was proposed in 1981. However, there are derived models that are similar to this one still in place today. And that's why we need to think forward and beyond cognitive theories of the body. In the cognitive theories, the cognitive engineering approach to the body is like, the body is just a mere physical support for the mind. This idea comes back to Descartes, a French philosopher who proposed this duality between body and mind. And then...
this was later Descartes.
Sure. A lot of people criticized Descartes. There's a huge movement in the 20th century, especially. It took some centuries to get a momentum. And Thomas Hobbes goes as far as to say that the body is a source of emotions that distract the mind. And you must control it, and therefore you need this state. So Hobbes writes this in the Leviathan, famous book that says that state is important to control society. And you need an absolute ruler, a king, a good king for that. Because people have bodies, and bodies are full of emotions, and they can do nasty things. And just doing that because it's the natural tendency of the body, is to kill other people, is to be nasty. And that's the theory of state of Hobbes. No philosopher said this, but I really make it radical. Like, it's a disgusting thing you cannot fully control. That's what is under, between the lines when I read cognitive theory. And a good movie that shows this perspective is Videodrome. Have you any of you watched? Welcome to this world. It's really a crazy, crazy movie. Have you watched any movie from David Cronenberg? Yes?
The Fly.
The Fly. So it's similar to The Fly. But I think it's even more gore. Videodrome was initially a horror movie, but really with a philosophical bent. It's not something you expect from a normal horror movie to have a deep philosophical reflection on the role of television in our society, but this movie really does that. And that's David Cronenberg. All his movies have interesting philosophical discussions. And it really contrasts with another movie he produced in the 90s. So Videodrome is from the 80s, at the peak of television society. Once everybody, I grew in the 80s and I grew in front of televisions. I was watching television all the time. My the kids at school were talking about television programs all the time. Everything was about television at that time. And in the 90s, there came the video games. The video games became really powerful among the kids, not so among the adults. I think adults started really playing a lot of video games in the 2000s on. So once we became adults, then, all right. We really put video game at the forefront. And this movie already shows a completely different idea of the body. It's like a body that is not separated from the mind. In the video trailer that you saw before, the narrator, he's saying, television can change your mind. Videodrome can change your body, right? Remember that? So body and mind are different in that movie. But in this movie, it's not different. It's no different, mind and body. And the way they do that is that David Cronenberg created a very crazy video game device that was organic. It was like an organ, artificial organ that you plug to your body and then provides you an existence in a virtual world. But this virtual world is social because other people that are connected to the same device, then they can interact with you inside that world. And people, of course, start having second lives, right? And the whole story is around the conflicts. And the cool thing about this movie is that it shows that the body is a political thing. It has a subject to dispute, and a lot of people are disputing the control for bodies in this movie. That's an interesting story. And bodies produce spatial relationships. Bodies produce spaces, and that's what happens once they connect to this devices. So I'm going to show you another trailer from Existence. I really recommend you guys to check those two movies from Cronenberg. You will not they will not disappoint you. You need to see those old-fashioned trailers, right? They're so different than trailers nowadays, right? They are much longer. They tell a story. They give you a lot of spoilers, I'd say. All right, guys. So I think we might be in a good time for a break, right? So 50 minutes for break. Then move your bodies. Activate them. Get something to eat or drink. All right. So we saw that there are two views, two perspectives on the body in human-computer interaction. The main one is cognitivist, and it really reduces the body to a mind, or either the body is just ignored. And now we saw the embodied, the phenomenological approach to the body. And I'm going to use this approach now for the next slides just to show what can you see and discuss and study if you depart from that perspective. So computers are altering the way we understand our world and how the way we interact with our world, much like cities did in the mid-millennium from the 15,000 tower nowadays. The life of the humans really changed. And the main device that made that change was cities. Because cities organized people around a small portion of place, of space, and people can interact much more. And that's the key point of a city, is to allow interactions. That's the same with computers. But the computers, they break through space, through physical space, and then people can interact on a worldwide scale. We still are not completely aware of all the implications of that change of living in such a globalized society, but we can already see some simple consequences, like children having very bad body formations, like body postures, and developing some diseases, even the posture diseases, that cannot be solved, like scoliosis. This cannot be solved after the child is, and a lot of heart, back pain, back pain people are having are associated, headaches are associated to increased use of computers in everyday activities. So everything basically now has some computer interface associated, and we need to stay in front of the computer many hours. I remember when the computer entered in my home place, my mother said, "You are only allowed to use the computer for 1 hour, no more than 1 hour." And 1 hour was a lot of time, and I enjoyed. And I didn't mind going away from the computer after 1 hour. But as the years passed, and it took, I would say, 5 years, I was staying in front of the computer for 10 hours in a row. And my mother, of course, she was at the beginning trying to stop me, but at some point she couldn't not, because that's where my life was happening. And I didn't know at the time this was so bad for me. So I developed scoliosis, back pain, all these things, and I cannot get rid of that. And I really would like to have better human-computer interfaces that would use my body much better than computers currently do. That's why I'm making the case for embodied interactions in this class. And another aspect of embodied interaction is that once you use your full body, you can, as we were discussing before, you can express tacit knowledge. You can show a child how to tie a shoe by putting your own hands together with the child's hands, and then you tie it. If you try to explain rationally and with the words, you can't really explain how to tie a knot.
I can never do a knot with a tie by just seeing a flow chart. It's impossible for me. If I see a video, I still can. I still have to try to put myself in his direction with a flow chart.
Some people can only dress a tie with the help of another person, like another person with a hand, like, and this is tacit knowledge, like it's knowledge that we have ingrained in our bodies. It's not just in our minds. It's really sensory motor memory, like we were discussing before too. The problem with the computer is that it relies a lot on sight, the vision sense, and because of that, it requires a lot of attention, because you need to be completely focused, looking at the screen all the time, otherwise you miss something. You cannot use your peripheral vision. Like when you are playing football, for example, you are looking at the ball, but you must also be looking at other players around you to see who you're going to pass the ball, who you're going to follow. And a lot of things are happening in the peripheral vision. And one of key part of the training of football players is to develop this peripheral vision. But for computers, this is not useful. Computer screens, they can get bigger and bigger and bigger, but they really do not use this opportunity. Because every single information shown in the computer requires total attention. You need to look at that completely. And because it's tiny, because it's small, because it's complex information, it does not provide contextual information, which is something different. Contextual information is like, you are looking at now at me, and you are seeing that there's some light coming from the door, right? And the light is still enlightening this room, and this room is brighter because of the light of there. So you know it's day. It's still in daylight. It's not evening yet. And it's becoming to get dawn because of the curvature of the light rays. So you see that they are entering. So the sun might be at certain. This is all information you get from your peripheral vision.
A pop-up
takes all your attention, and people are considering now the next step for human computer interaction is to put to wear 3D glasses, like what's the name of the most famous one, the Oculus Rift. Wearing 3D virtual reality glasses. Virtual reality glasses, they really throw away peripheral vision. You can't see anything peripheral with that. You restrict your eye vision to this, like while here you have a wide range, and here you only look at that. But even some advanced virtual reality helmets, they have a wide range, but they don't allow you to see anything relevant in this peripheral vision, because they only show things that matter to you in front. And this thing is in high resolution. And these things on the right and left are also in high resolution. But that's not how our vision works. Our vision is blurred on the sides. And that's good, because you don't need to focus on it. That's why you have the fovea area, where you really need to focus. Here you just need to get conceptually information that are more like abstract and generic, like illumination, like lightning, like color, like shape, like movement. Those things are things that you can use for conveying information too, but unfortunately computer does not use it. Not to speak about other senses like smell. You can convey information with smell. You can convey information with movements, with hearing, with sounds. And these are not really much explored. The computer basically reduces the human body to a device. The computer treats the user as, or the body of the user as a device that has some sensors for audio, for visual stimuli, and it can also input some simple information through a finger, right? And it's distorted, and it's funny, this image, just to show how weird computers treat us. And it's also a pity that human-computer interaction research does not address that much. This is not, embodied interaction is not really a major theory in human-computer interaction. And it's not so, not, there are not many people that consider that. And they talk about users in generic terms. Users, that's my user, that's not my user. The user does that, does this, the user does that. But who is this user? What's the history of that user? What's the gender? What are the political views of that user? That does not matter for my HCI project. A lot of HCI does not really go much into details on the user part of the interaction. They just suppose that there's an abstract person who's very, very stupid. The person does not know how to use the computer. The person is always wrong. It's kind of a prejudice against someone else. So what I'm proposing to you is an approach that combines embodied interaction and applies to wearable computing. So computing power close to the body. Why? Because you need specific applications for specific situations. It's not just application for doing everything. It's just for doing one thing or two things very well done. These interfaces can be used with peripheral vision and also other senses than sight, like what's the name? Haptics. What's the name of the sense? Touch. The sense of touch. And they provide personalized experiences because every person using gets something different. This embodied wearable computer approach is linked to a movement called quantified self. Quantified self are people who cares about their data, the data they are generating using wearable computers and using other kinds of computer stuff, and they really want to use that data to reflect and change their own behavior. A guy called Feltron, he's a designer, while working as a designer at Facebook, he was doing a side project at the end of the year. He was compiling an annual report, quite cool annual report, where he would show everything he was doing that during that year, like his heart rate along the year, his weight, how much it changed. Like you can see that he lost weight along the year, and how much he drank along the year. So you could even see if in one day he was drunk and also driving. You could correlate those informations. And why in the hell a person would do that? Well, he wanted to discuss. It's an art project. And since he's also working for Facebook, he probably got a lot of interest into the way data interferes with our lives and the way we interfere with data, on the other hand. And he stopped doing this project in 2014. Because it was quite demanding. He had to carry on an application, special application in his phone, that would ask him, what are you doing every 15 minutes? And he would have to type. Every 15 minutes, through 8 years in his life, he was answering that. He was really patient. But then he created this app and put it on the App Store. So you can now download his app and you can customize the questions the system will ask you, and you can also generate graphics like he did. So you can do it to yourself. You can repeat the experiment if you want. Reporter app is the name of the app he developed. And that's definitely something not related to wearable computers, because it's not wearable. You can use with your phone and but the point of this quantified movement, and this example I showed to you, quantified self movement, an example I showed to you, is that people are really worried about their data, and they really want to use that data to exist. So once they look back and see everything they have done, they realize their existence, who they are, what they do in this world. This is a quite objective way of being in the world, and people are looking for that, for meaning in their lives, and sometimes data is the most hard thing we can see about yourselves. And now, coming back to changing human behavior, as I said, people want to change their behavior using data. Sometimes, currently, a lot of people are wondered about sleep trackers. And an iPhone like this one, it has an inbuilt sleep tracker, so I can just turn it on, and it will record my sleep patterns if I put my phone next to me while sleeping. It might record noises. I don't know how it detects. I think it's through noise, my snoring noises, I don't know. And it can tell you what's the time that you're sleeping, which kind of sleep is that one, when once you wake up and go to the bathroom, or something like that. This is the sleep trackers. Also shows how much time you really slept well. And a lot of people that have sleep disorders that target users for these apps, they are complaining to their physicians that they are getting worse by using these sleep trackers because they get anxious. They get anxious that they are not sleeping enough. And then when they, once they go to sleep, they turn on the sleep tracker and they wait for having a really good sleep. And they get really bad, worse, because they look at the graphs and they see that they are sleeping worse and worse and worse. It's kind of create a kind of a vicious circle that a person cannot break through. So a lot of physicians are not recommending using sleep patterns for people that have sleep disorders. And of course, there are wearables. Since they are so close to the body, they can change the behavior of the person or the other persons. They raise ethical questions that are really important for the project, for the designers themselves and the organizations. This example of a design project from our students, Kevin Cruz, Patricia Lupi, and Walter Vianne, really rose a really heated discussion in our classroom some years ago. They created a necklace that a smart necklace that a boyfriend could give to his girlfriend. And the girlfriend could be watched with this necklace. So you could control the whatever the girlfriend was doing. And the girlfriend, on the other hand, would receive some information from him, some like love declarations and audio, this kind of romantic stuff. And they built this project definitely to stimulate debate. It's a critical design project. It's not something that you seriously. But think about it. It's just a matter of time for Japanese tech guys create this stuff, right? even if it haven't already done that. Maybe it's already done.
In a sense, people that develop relationships where they expect someone to reply at the time, send a message, it's like this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This WhatsApp thing that tells you people are writing or not, yeah. They read already your message or not read, this really creates a tension and also a control mechanism between people. And that's definitely something that should be discussed ethically. And so my friend Gonzato, our colleague here, professor, teacher at our Architecture Design School, Rodrigo Gonzato, we wrote a paper last year about this relationship that our students have with their bodies and the technologies, and how they take some time for them to get to realize how much technology influences their bodies and tries to change their behaviors. So we ask them to create some clay models every day, at the end of the every day, and during 1 week, and reflect about all the pressures they feel from society and the role of technology in that. And they start really to realize those small, tiny details of WhatsApp influencing their lives and creating more jealously among their relationships and so on. That's what we call conscious body, you know, in this paper. We tell the conscious body is a person who knows what are the conditionings and freedoms that they have in their actions.
It's a Buddha.
What? This is a Buddha?
Yeah,
I don't remember what it means. But I think it is something like that. And there are other people developing projects, wearable computers, wearables devices that tries to criticize the relationships that we take for granted, raising those ethical issues or social issues, like the computer hood for people who cares about privacy. And you look at that and you say, what the fuck? What is that? Why do you need such a thing? Well, privacy is something that people are saying is gone, right? Mark Zuckerberg says nobody cares about privacy any longer. But people do care about privacy. And the problem with privacy not being taken care of is also related to the invisibility of privacy. You don't see privacy any longer. In the past, you would just shut down a door, and then you would have privacy. Everybody knew you were in private mode, and they would knock on the door if they want to enter your home. But now, if you are in a computer, and if you wanted to go private mode, you don't have it. If you do it, nobody will know you are doing it. So in here, you have a private mode that everybody around you can understand you want to stay alone. But if you want to scratch your nose, you still have a small hole here to put your hand. This is the funny part of the project. Embodied Suffering is a project that tries to create awareness for someone else's anxiety. We spoke about the way wearable computers try to change our behaviors directly, but here, this is indirectly. So a wearable computer tries to connect to someone else. I will show you the video because I think it's a bit difficult to understand. So there are two guys, they are looking at each other. They have this sensor and also an actuator that inflict pain to them. So what does the pain it inflicts come depends on what the anxiety of the other person. So if the other person is anxious, you feel the pain. So you're basically feeling the anxiety of the other person. And that goes in two ways. So you start basically to feel the anxiety of the other person. The other person feels the anxiety of yourself. And there is a 3D module that fabricates the anxiety model for the two guys. This is the part that they share in the end, and they put the half of the sphere together. The sphere is like a 3D representation of the level of anxiety of each other. It's kind of a strange project, right? But I love it because it's really about meeting someone else, and once you meet someone else which is so different than you, you have so much hopes, so many fears, so many prejudices, and this is like being captured by this project. I like that. It's definitely an art project, not a consumer product. And Sarotis, and this is the another example of embodied wearable device, is a soft robot to feel what it's like being in a virtual space while being in a physical space. So you use physical space to feel a virtual space through these soft robots. It's also an interesting different project. So it's a very strange project that shows a different way of conveying information, like through haptics, through sense of touch, and it's very cheap actually to build these soft robots. They are silicon, made of silicon, and some motors that put air through it, like bombas, I don't know how it's named, pump, like air pumps, that make the actuation work. And it's quite fun to feel it. Like, we really miss this kind of stuff in human-computer interaction. And it's funny that the guys who are trying to do that, they're not computer scientists, they're architects. So you saw that it's an architecture school from Bartlett at London that built this project. And I really like this kind of interdisciplinary exchanges between computer science and architecture and design. Wearables can also replace body functions and create human hybrids, like this fellow senior patient. He is wearing an artificial kidney. He's a terminal patient in kidney cancer, but he has his life improved because it does not need to be attached to a dialysis machine for 5 hours in a row, which is a common thing for every week for dialysis patients. So he can, while doing his dialysis, the 5 hours thing, carry on a heavy, what's the name of this? Belt, exactly, heavy belt, where this the blood will be cleaned up. Well, blood, no, the what's yeah, the blood will clean up. Yeah. In sum, interactions always start from a human body and affects another human body. And the best example, like the symbolic example of embodied and wearable computers, are these shirts, hug shirts created by Qt Circuit. It's a hug shirt that you can feel a hug from distance. So you hug yourself, and it has sensors, and it, and on the other side, it has actuators, so the person feels warm where you are hugging, and the person can answer back the hug by doing some movements, and you feel like you're being hugged at distance. It's not a functional thing, but a lot of things in our lives are not functional. They are also emotional and they are affective. And this is also an important part of human life. So embodied interactions, they have the power to make visible things like alterity relations, like the way we change by interacting with other people. And Intimacy 2.0 is a fashion project by Daniel Rosenhardt, who is a Dutch designer. I met him also at the University of Twente. He is really crazy. He created a series of clothes that become transparent once you start sharing a lot of information about yourself and the social networks. So as much as you share on Facebook, as much you get dressed, undressed and naked. So basically you're getting naked in real life, not just virtual life. And some people are they are conscious that they are doing that, so they might get interested into wearing that, because if they want to get attention in virtual life, why not getting attention in physical life too? It's weird, I know, but the point is to discuss and to explore and reflect. Is this the society we want? Because it's weird once we see in this form, in this physical shape, but it's not weird once we do it in a virtual life. Why don't we think it's weird to share your whole life on Facebook, and we think it's weird to show your body in public, like using the Intimacy 2.0 project? It's the same mechanism of social visibility. And wearables, they make it tangible, things that are virtual, and we carry on close to our bodies in a way that people might realize that all these virtual things we do in the computers are affecting our habits, our behaviors, in the same way than these wearable devices.
I think this is important because when you think about it, you're exposing yourself much more on a social network than you are in the physical world, because you have so much more range, so much more people are seeing. So if you post a picture of you in a swimsuit, more people are seeing most likely than if you were actually wearing one.
Exactly. Yeah. Good point.
You're more anxious about it in the real world.
Yeah.
So I think it's a good project.
Yeah. So now I'm going to switch from describing the state of the art and also the main challenges of the field. I'm switching to how to do about this. What to do in the design, in the interaction design. So this is an embodied interactions approach for designing. And the first thing we reject in this approach, those cognitive definitions of design process. Like, who knows? Does anyone of you know what this process is called? How is this process called? This is design thinking. Empathize, define, ideate, and prototype, test. This is not embodied interaction approach. This is cognitive approach. This says that design is following these 5 steps. And embodied interaction would say, well, design is a full body activity where people interact with their bodies. They think about bodies. They also touch bodies. They also design bodies. And if you just follow some steps, doesn't mean you are really interacting with the body. It's too abstract, the diagrams we saw before. This is the reality of design. Studio education. We already spoke about this in the past, how studio education is important for architecture and design schools, and how this is also becoming more important for human-computer interaction courses and also computer science courses and software engineering courses like the Apple Developer Academy program. And this is all come from Bauhaus School and the École des Arts in France. So we are recovering that story, that history. And the way I do, and also together with my colleague Gonzato, we wrote a paper about using theater in our classrooms to enable these kind of studio-like interactions. These rooms are not exactly studios, but we adapt them and we turn them into studios once you apply some theater techniques. And here we see prototyping. They are prototyping system for controlling employees that are manufacturing something. And this girl is his boss. Here, these four students are creating a concept for their project. They are discussing and using materials for discussing that. They're all using their bodies in a much more active way than just sitting in front of a computer. So, now we finally came to the exercise part of the course, all right? Shall we start moving around? So I'm going to